Hello, this is your host, Todd Lewis of the Praise of Folly podcast. I'm joined again by Keith Preston and Derek Jensen, here to discuss the topic of the triumph of capitalism and the failure of the historic left to combat that. So while the left has evolved a lot over the last, say, 250 years from Rousseau till today, one thing that seems to have been a common thread in all historic left-wing thinking is what Noam Chomsky would call the opposition to private power. And the need to dismantle private institutions, such as, you know, business private institutions. And while we could say maybe the high watermark for the anarchist left would have been the early 20th century with, like, the CNTFI in Spain, the high watermark of the statist left would have been the Soviet Union sometime in the 70s or 80s. We see that with the collapse of the USSR and prior to that, the collapse of the anarchist movement, that nobody can reasonably argue that there is really any organized left anymore. I remember Van Jones, one of the czars for Obama, was writing. There were the right-wing critics of Obama and his appointments pointed to an essay that Van Jones had written like in the 90s talking about the collapse of the international left with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And what's interesting is I don't see a lot of modern-day leftists who attempt to maintain connection with that strand of the historic left, who realistically discuss and engage with these failures. What I think is a place to start is sort of work from the top down. So the first thing I'd say is if we look at the modern society, the modern age, it's dominated by what Jacques Ellul called technique. And he defines technique in the technological society this way. In our technological society, technique is the totality of method rationally arrived at, and having absolute efficiency for a given stage of development. In every field of human activity, its characteristics are new. The technique of the present has no common measure with that of the past. So while technique is not limited to machines and technology, but to a broader human organization, it certainly includes that. And one of the things that the historic left used to propose and argue was that it was more efficient than capitalism, rationally organized production. Marxism was scientific. And the idea was that they could, the unspoken assumption was that the socialism could meet the needs of technique better than capitalism. And it would seem that capitalism triumphed because within the rules of that competitive structure, it was better able to meet the needs of technique based on, in part, I think, the high capital cost for building machines and organizing people in this way. And it was just better at meeting the needs of those capital costs than socialism was. So one could argue that socialism in regards was competing on capitalism's terms. Another way you could look at it is prior to the rise of in the Enlightenment and modernity, there is a certain consistent view of reality based on the divine and hierarchical structures, you know, the Anshan regime or, you know, medieval institutions that were internally self-consistent and were sustainable in the sense that they could be maintained from generation to generation to generation. The Enlightenment with its principles of the tabula rasa, the individual, the fungibility of people, the idea that you could control the environment and then bend it to your will, In that regard was a sort of self-consistent rejection of this older view. And as Chomsky points out, that the socialists and the sort of like are the left wing of the Enlightenment, and in many ways the capitalists are the right wing of the Enlightenment, and they're both arguing over who is the true heir to Enlightenment principles. And I think one of the problems is that the socialist left, which talks about, you know, a sort of rationally planned economy, a sort of radical communitarianism or collectivization of the means of production, is completely opposite any sort of individualism. So one of the things that I thought was odd about anarchists is on the one hand, they talk about the individual against the state. And then they would talk in the very next mouth, collectivism. Now that would be the classic left anarchist, not American individualist anarchists or egoists. But those two traditions tend to be less well known than the classic left anarchists of Proudhon and Bakunin and Kropotkin. And it's like, well, you can't have both. I mean, which is it? Is it individualism, individual against the state? I mean, even Murray Bookchin later renounced the sort of collectivist anarchism, you know, when he said that the call to organize was collectivistic, whereas, you know, Stirner was an individualist. And so then the question is, do the principles of the Enlightenment tend towards a radical individualism, or do they tend towards a sort of collectivism? And I would argue that the triumph of capitalism is in some sense rooted in the fact that these values, if you follow them to their logical conclusion, tend towards individualism. And so one way the left failed was it adopted the founding principles or fundamental starting points of right-wing, you know, the right of the Enlightenment capitalism, but then tried to build something else on top without having its own internally consistent separate set of assumptions. And so I would argue that at least at those two levels, we can sort of see, using the analogy that the fish rots from the head, that socialism and the historic left have in some sense failed to defeat capitalism in part on these sort of broader philosophical assumptions. We'll start with you, Derek. What are some of your thoughts on all this?
Well, I think there's a lot that you said that is really interesting and right. And I think I would probably, quibble with a few things. One of them is that I'm not sure that I would consider the Soviet Union to have been left. And I don't know that I would consider it to have been communism. I would have considered it. I think I was really influenced by Chomsky back in the 80s, I think, when he wrote about how it's sort of two forms of state-sponsored capitalism. And I think then my own analysis I sort of came to the same conclusion from a different direction when I realized, God, I don't remember what it was. I think I was reading who was the guy who had the German Revolution in the 15th century? His name starts with an M.
Munster, Thomas Munster?
I think so. Is he the one who was eventually captured under a bed and beheaded?
Thomas Munzer. I think that's the guy.
Yeah. It's something like that. Anyway, he had this line about how, he was very much a communitarian, and somehow as I was reading about him and then thinking about the Soviet Union, I realized that if you have production, then your resources have to be sent toward the producers, whether you are talking about Weyerhaeuser or whatever the state-sponsored timber company of the Soviet Union would have been, that in either case, or even if the entity is owned by horny-handed workers, as they said, then that still doesn't alter the fact that the resources have to be sent to them. So I think I would end up sort of disagreeing with you on terminology, but agreeing with you on analysis. I think we're agreeing in that if you have production of the sort that emerged from the Enlightenment, as opposed to the earlier, sort of truly community based. Okay, here's what I'm trying to get at, is there is a contradiction in the process of especially industrial production itself that disallows for a communitarianism. And I can attempt to defend that if you want me to, or we can just move on.
No, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's like I said, that you have, as soon as you prioritize production over community, you are going to fairly quickly run into the fact that economies of scale make it so there will be accumulation. And this is something that has happened. This is what the Luddites were fighting. This is what happened in the United States to small farms starting in the 50s. This is what happened to organic farms with the organic standards in the 90s. This is what's happened to the marijuana movement or the marijuana. I live in Northern California, so this is something that's fairly close to me. And also I wrote a book on it that's out, looking for a publisher right now, about how marijuana's illegality made it so economies of scale could not drive out small farmers. That you can't have a square block greenhouse without getting arrested. And so it illegality, oddly enough, ended up benefiting all the local communities that were in many ways based on this, on the small artisanal grower. And legality has changed that such that they've been driven out. Now four economic entities control the marijuana production in Colorado. Same thing is happening in Washington, Oregon. Same thing is happening in California. And so, and my point with all this would be to go back sort of to Lewis Mumford, to whom I go back quite often, and talk about authoritarian techniques and how I think we all pretty much agree that sort of historical and technological forces are incredibly important for social structure. And when you have a way of life that's based on mining, then you are going to end up with certain social forms required, authoritarian social forms required. And when you have a way of life based on manufacturing, okay, here's an easy way to say it. You, Keith, or you, Todd, or me, none of us can individually make an automobile from scratch. We can, on the other hand, plant an apple seed and eventually eat apples from that tree. We could, you know, do the same thing with potatoes, but we cannot do that with an automobile. And so if you're going to have automobiles, you have to have these huge entities and you have to have the entire system that goes with them. I'm going to say one more thing and then I'll shut up, which is that I was getting interviewed by this guy several years ago, for Nature magazine. And he was a dedicated Marxist who believed it was possible to have an industrial system with only purely voluntary exchanges where no one was exploited. And I said, great, do you have cities? He said, yes. I said, great, how do you get around in your cities? And he said, by a bus or by buses. I said, what are the buses made of? He said, they're made of metal. I said, great, where do you get the metal? He said, mines. I said, great, where do you get the workers for the mines? And he said, you just pay people. And I said, well, mining has been such a miserable existence all throughout history that for the most part, it was one of the first forms of slavery. But I'm going to give you that one. I'm going to let you just pay them a whole bunch of money to spend their lives underground. But what do you do with the fact that every hard rock mine in the world pollutes groundwater? He said, well, what's the problem with that? And I said, well, there are, forgetting non-humans, there are people who are humans who live next to the river, and now their water's going to be polluted. So what are you doing? He said, well, you pay them to move. I said, what if they don't want to move? He said, you pay them more. I said, well, what if they've lived there for 5,000 years, their ancestors are buried in the soil, and they will not move, no matter how much you pay them? He said, well, how many were there? I said, what difference does that make? 500. He said, well, the million people in the city vote, and they vote that the 500 people next to the river have to be evicted. I said, okay, great. Within less than a minute, you have moved from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, land theft from indigenous people, and genocide. Also, you can have a bus. And the point is that the act of industrial production demands certain social forms. And I don't know if this is just a long-winded way of saying the same thing you did, or if it's saying something else.
No, I think we're sort of getting at something from different perspectives, but I kind of want to hear Keith on this.
Yeah, well, when socialism or anti-capitalism or whatever we want to call it first developed, it was in the early 19th century, and it was in response to what was the nascent Industrial Revolution. And we did a program with this once, Todd, but, you know, early on, in fact, Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto criticized this. Early on, socialism just kind of meant, it was sort of a euphemism for social reform generally. You know, anybody that was in favor of reforming the industrial economy was a quote unquote socialist. And Marx and Engels, of course, in the Communist Manifesto, they really lambasted this. They said that these people are quacks. You know, there can't be feudal socialism. There can't be utopian socialism. There's only what they thought was scientific socialism. But I think what's interesting is to look at the way socialism evolved historically. The countries that adopted socialist ideology as their, you know, ideological superstructure or whatever, were all countries that Marx and Engels would have said were not prepared to be socialists. It was Russia, China, you know, basically what we would, you know, would call third world countries, essentially pre-industrial or largely pre-industrial countries. And Marx and Engels and the early socialists, or certainly their early followers, would have said, well, those countries can't be socialists. They don't have any industry. They're agricultural societies. But what you see that's interesting is that in these predominantly agricultural societies where you had, quote-unquote, socialist governments, Russia, China, and some others, a lot of those places, what they ended up producing was a model of production that was very similar to the ancient empires. It was very similar to Egypt and Babylon and places like that, where you had a leader who's sort of like a god emperor, you know, the guy, you know, like a Stalin or Mao or Pol Pot or Kim Il-sung, you know, one of these guys are godlike figures. And, you know, of course, everybody's supposed to worship them or, you know, de facto worship them. There's this cult of the state that's built up around them. And then the model of production and distribution of resources is almost like what you would find in the military. I mean, if you want to look at, you know, what a Soviet model economy would look like applied in the Western world, look at the military. That's what the military is. You know, everybody has a rank and an assigned position in the military, and then you're rationed resources based on, you know, what they think you need. Internally, the military is not a market capitalist economy. I mean, certainly the armaments industry is, but, you know, internally, in terms of the way the distribution of resources is done in the military, that's somewhat similar to the way that the Soviet model economy actually worked. So what they did in those countries was sort of recreate this kind of ancient model of an economy. It's very similar to what you find in these very ancient societies. In the developed world, or what was becoming the developed world, I think the issue there is that the socialists never anticipated how resilient capitalism was going to be. The main issue that you have there is that, you know, Marx, of course, predicted that capitalism would produce immiseration to the point that capitalism would collapse and the workers would say they've had enough and then they would take over. And to some degree, that's what happened with the Great Depression. I mean, you got to the point where internationally capitalism in that classical model of capitalism, that 19th century model, largely did collapse internationally. But what came out of it was something different. And that was, you had this kind of bureaucratic revolution, the managerial revolution. Like James Burnham, his work in this, I think, is the very best there is. He was a former Trotskyist, who later became sort of a Machiavellian type of conservative. But he published a book back in the 1940s called The Managerial Revolution, and he was talking about how governments around the world were responding to the Great Depression and the collapse of capitalism, you know, the old bourgeois model of capitalism. And he was saying, what we're seeing now is a new kind of system developed that's not really the old model of capitalism, and it's not really socialism the way Marx or the historic socialist envisioned it. Instead, we have the proliferation of these bureaucracies, these managerial bureaucracies that control everything. It's the era of mass organizations, like, you know, we have mass corporations, mass unions, mass government agencies, you know, mass technological services and, you know, all kinds of things in a way that, you know, everything is getting bigger and bigger and bigger on an institutional scale, in ways that you didn't have in older societies. And I think he more or less attributed that to just, the things the two of you have been talking about, which is technological, features. That is, you know, the more, one thing you see in the 20th century is you see massive population growth. You see very, very rapid, unprecedented technological expansion. And with all of those kinds of things, you have to have much higher degrees of specialization. As Derek was saying, if you're just going to make shoes, you know, like one person can make shoes. It can be a cobbler and be a shoemaker and make shoes. But, you know, you're not going to make a car, much less, you know, a computer, you know, with just one person in a garage, you know, and one person is not going to assemble all the components you need for that. So you have to have some mass system of mass production with a very high degree of specialization for that. And then when you to have specialization, you have to have highly specialized training, supervision, all of these kinds of things. I mean, that's why you start to see mass education becoming much more common during this time period, where more and more people go to universities and universities get bigger and they offer a much wider variety of programs and things like that. So the big question is, you have the rise of mass society and these kinds of technologically driven societies. And how does that relate to the effort to replace capitalism with some kind of socialism? Well, you could argue that historic capitalism, like the old, you know, mom and pop type of capitalism, where you have like the one guy at the top who sort of leads the corporation, you know, the kind of Rockefeller type of capitalism. You could argue that that was replaced with this kind of managerial capitalism. And you could also argue with the digital revolution, we're actually seeing a return to that. We're actually seeing a return to the older model of capitalism, where now you have these tech oligarchs, these guys like Bezos and Bill Gates and Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey. I mean, those guys, Elon Musk, those guys are the John D. Rockefellers and Andrew Carnegies and characters like that from the 19th century. Those are our 21st century version of that. So it's like we're going in full circle. You know, we now have 19th century capitalism all over again, only with 21st century technology. So the capitalism, I think, turned out to be much more resilient than what its early critics gave it credit for. It was able to adjust to changing social circumstances. It was able to adjust to changing technological circumstances. It was able to harness new technologies and make it, you know, bend it towards its own interests. You know, even to the point that for a time you saw a rising living standards on the part of the working class. Like, that's starting to go backwards now. But in the, say, the post-war era in the United States, for really the first time in history, you had a working class that more or less lived like an upper middle class. You know, like, that's what I came from. You know, my family background was working class, but then, you know, my parents, they were part of that working class of the post-war era that, you know, basically had an upper middle class standard of living, even though we were technically working class. In fact, even today, my parents, who are now in their 80s, when I say something bad about capitalism, they're like, no, we've done well with capitalism, you know. But I'm like, well, it's kind of going backwards now, but I think that's really the issue there, though, in that sense, that, you know, what happened in the Eastern world was something that had nothing to do with capitalism, and then what happened in the Western world was that capitalism was able to reinvent itself, you know, according to the social changes and technological changes and cultural changes of its time. You know, just like, I mean, it's interesting that today to see the way that capitalism corporations are developing this kind of progressive ideological gloss now, where, you know, capitalist corporations today are all about Black Lives Matter and Pride Month and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Just like in the 1950s, they would have been for anti-communism or something. Yeah. You know? So it's, I mean, that they just keep adapting capitalism to whole new circumstances.
Yeah, I think maybe to slightly reiterate what I said at the beginning, Sun Tzu says that when you engage with an enemy, you don't engage him on his terms, but on your terms, because on his terms, he has the advantage and will win. And if you look at any given economic system has a underlying set of assumptions that go into it. And what I think much of the left has done across the spectrum from libertarian left to authoritarian left is assume a lot of principles that those who embrace a capitalist mode of production would also assume. And by assuming the same principles at the expense of, say, an earlier set of beliefs that we might associate with traditional societies, the left on that spectrum began competing with capitalism on its own terms, which meant that they were at a competitive disadvantage because they'd already conceded too much. So, for example, the idea of tabula rasa, man is a tabula rasa and therefore fungible. Well, fungibility in economic sense means that all components are more or less the same for economic use. And of course, if you have a society that views humans as fungible, what that ends up doing is it ends up undercutting or essentially blank slates with no prior obligations or commitments or intellectual content in them. It sort of undercuts any sort of solidarity because we're just these, you know, random fungible, you know, widgets that don't have any relationship to anything else. And so that's very handy for an industrial capitalist production system, not so handy for a collectivized, you know, rationally planned economy or even a more traditional agrarian economy. And with regards, you know, where does something like solidarity come from? I mean, if you look at it in, say, an older pre-left concept, solidarity is sort of rooted in a community, right? You grow up in a community, you grow up in a tribe, you have a shared set of beliefs and values. Sort of like if you've ever read Alistair MacIntyre's After Virtue, he has this whole idea of a classical concept of morality and being. And the outcast was somebody who just lived outside of that assumed culture. And so by doing that, it sort of modern society makes everybody an outcast. That's in fact what he's getting at in After Virtue. And he argues that's leading to a crisis of identity and cohesion in the West. Now that works really well for the commodification of life, but I don't think it works very well with trying to build a socialist alternative. And so I think that one of the problems is, among others, there are assumptions that are made by many on the left that actually undercut the end state that they want to get to. And I think there's a lack of self-awareness in that. Derek, do you have anything you want to say about that? You're still muted, Derek.
I don't know if this is on topic or not, but I'm thinking about internal contradictions, and I think we all know that Bob Black is pretty crazy and not an exemplar of fine anarchist thought. But nonetheless, there's something he said that has really pointed me to a contradiction in a lot of these. And maybe I'm just saying the same thing I said before about the buses, that Bob Black at some point talks about, in an anarchist society, where people are not doing any jobs they don't want to do, he recognizes that there is difficulty because if you live in a city, you still have to have a sewage system. And his solution to this, which he says is a joke, but he actually doesn't provide any other solutions, is that children like playing around in filth, so send children down to work your sewage system. Now, ignoring child labor, this is just a really good way to get a lot of people killed. And I know, like I said, I preface this by saying I'm kind of off topic here, but I'm coming back to the same thing about if that certain physical conditions of living end up requiring certain social circumstances. And if you're going to have a bunch of people living in a city and not dying of cholera, somebody has to work a sewage treatment plant. And somebody has to go down and clean out the sewers or repair the sewers or whatever it is you do with the sewers. And I don't think it should be children. And this goes back to the specialization thing too, because I've also seen Bob Black argue, and again, I'm giving him too much credit because he doesn't deserve any credit at all. But I've seen him argue that people should not have specialized jobs. And I don't know if either of you have ever had surgery, but I had open heart surgery, and I'm glad that it was actually a surgeon, a heart surgeon, who conducted this, and an anesthesiologist who ran the anesthetics, as opposed to, nothing against sewage treatment workers, but I don't think that those are interchangeable skills. I also wouldn't want the surgeon running the sewage treatment plant. And I guess I just keep coming back to, I'm such a big believer in the notion of like historical forces and technological forces that, like, okay, I thought that our entire, I'm great with this conversation. I love talking to you guys, and this is, I love how we bring different things to the table, but I thought this conversation was going to go a different direction, which is totally cool that it isn't. And I've been thinking a lot about the failure of the left. And one of the things that I was thinking about, I've thought about a lot, is that it's really that one of the reasons we've ended up with identity politics so much is because when you have the declining standard of living, then the left has to come up with something to stay relevant at all. And so they picked up identity politics, since class politics is not going to work in a world of declining standard of income because of ecological limits. And then I was thinking also about, and this is going to have a point very shortly, I was thinking also about how, you know, it's great that women are allowed to work as neurosurgeons, or that they can, you know, get whatever jobs they want. That's really great. But there's a downside, not to women working, but there's a downside, and I'm not valorizing the nuclear family either, but there's a downside to having two parents working. And I fully believe that part of the reason that women were encouraged to get jobs is because no longer was one income enough to support a family. And so instead of saying, God, things are really going downhill, and now you have to have two people working in order to support a family, instead they said, isn't this great and liberating that women get to work? And again, I don't have a problem with women working. I do have a problem with children being raised with no one present oftentimes. And the whole point of this is, I had an idea for a book yesterday, which I'll put it way down on the list, and God knows if I'll ever write it. But the idea was, instead of talking about left versus right, I want to write a book with the title that's something like Cluster Bs versus Everyone. Cluster Bs are people with a certain cluster of psychological disorders, narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder. And this is taking us way the hell off track, and we can just do a different discussion about this another day. But I can't really speak so much to the right, but the left these days has been completely overtaken by cluster Bs. And anyway, so, and that I think comes back to historical forces again, because of the declining standards of living that have caused people to be raised with people to be raised with the television, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I know that's way the hell off topic, but you can, either of you or both of you can just make what you will of any of that.
Well, yeah. What are some of your thoughts, Keith?
Yeah, well, I mentioned earlier that we seem to have come full circle in the sense that we're almost like we're back to the 19th century again, because we live in a time of very, very rapid social change and very, very rapid technological growth. Similar to what happened in the 19th century. I mean, think about what it would be like to live in the 19th century, and all of a sudden automobiles are being developed and telephones and, you know, all these things people had never heard of before would have thought were science fiction if you had mentioned it to them. Well, it's kind of like that today, you know, with the kind of technological developments we see now. At the same time in the 19th century, like as I said earlier, you had these plutocrats that had displaced the older traditional elites, you know, instead of the traditional royalty and aristocracy and clerisy, you started to have these bourgeois capitalists, these John D. Rockefeller types. And like, well, we've got that again now. We've got that with Bezos and Elon Musk and all these kinds of characters. So in some ways, we are back to the 19th century. And also, there's a very rapid change in social norms as well. You saw that happen in the 19th century, where you saw the breakdown of these traditional agrarian, communal type societies towards this more individualistic, urbanized kind of culture. And we see parallels to that today as well. So it's very similar to what we had over a century and a half ago. And the way the left is going is ironically somewhat similar to what it was like in the early 19th century as well, in the sense that nowadays you see more and more people who identify as socialists. You know, that label now is becoming popular again. But then when you ask people what they mean by that, they don't have a clue. And again, it gets back to what Marx was saying in the Communist Manifesto. We've got all these people out here that call themselves socialists. They don't have a clue what they're talking about. I know Todd and I debated a couple of socialist guys a while back, and I'd say, I'm not sure about Todd, but I'd say compared to the two guys we debated, I was probably the most Marxist person on the panel, even though I was making an anti-Marxist argument. You know,
totally.
Yeah, because the two guys I was debating, they were supposed to be defending socialism. They didn't have a clue what it was. I mean, they were basically they were saying, well, socialism is the welfare state and it's, worker-owned businesses and things like that. You know, workers' capitalism. I mean, even Ludwig von Mises, the 20th century's leading critic of socialism, even he didn't consider worker-owned businesses to be socialism. He just called that workers' capitalism. You know, he said, yeah, it's the syndicalists and people like that advocate for that. They're just workers' capitalists. Historic socialism, certainly, from Marx onward, if not before, was the idea of abolishing commodification, abolishing market relations, abolishing the law of value. I started bringing this up in our debate, as Todd will remember, and, those guys didn't even know what I was talking about. It's like they never even heard of this stuff before, but, yeah, so nowadays we're back to sort of like it was in the 19th century with the left. You know, it's like you've got all these people that say, okay, something's wrong. Something's wrong with the world out there, so we don't really know what. So, okay, I'll be a socialist, because I just think things ought to change or whatever. And we see that now with the YouTube left. You know, we see the so-called bread tube, and we see all these people on the so-called left that are developing a fetish for what they call tankies nowadays. You know, they're into Soviet aesthetics or Maoist aesthetics or something like that, even though most of them just seem to be larvers. I mean, it's like it's like the ones on the far right that a few years ago were developing a fetish for traditionalism or something like that. You know, so you had all these, waspish people, these waspish guys on the far right who would suddenly convert to Eastern Orthodox religion and grow their beard out like a death metal guy or something. It just seems like there are these subcultures that are developing that I think are sort of a reaction against the wider society. People aren't happy with the wider society, so they're just developing these subcultures that are oppositional, based on, whatever. What I'm curious about is where that's going to lead in the future. And I think that, as far as what Derek was saying about specialization and these kinds of things, this was a problem for the old socialists and anarchists and others like that from the 19th century and early 20th century. That was, because one thing they were concerned about was the breakdown of traditional communities. You no longer had these small towns and farming villages and things like that. Those were disappearing. You were getting these mass cities and these mass industrial centers and mass societies and things like that. And they were concerned about the loss of community and things like that that was being generated by this. I mean, even Marx talked about that. And then there was also concerns about the centralization of power that was inherent in industrialization. The anarchists, one of the reasons that the historic anarchists were anti-capitalist, I talk to libertarians a lot these days, modern American-style libertarians, like followers of Ayn Rand and Murray Rothbard and Milton Friedman and all those people, you know, and they'll say, yeah, well, the problem with those old anarchists is they were against capitalism. You know, capitalism is the free market, whereas, you know, the socialism is statism. You know, that's not anarchism. But the criticism that the old, one of the criticisms that the old anarchists had of capitalism was that it was centralizing power. You know, it was paralleling the growth of these larger states, for one thing, and mass armies and these kinds of things. But also, along with that, industrial institutions themselves were becoming authoritarian entities. I mean, you had company towns in those days where, you know, even though workers were not legally considered slaves, they might as well have been because they had a slave-like existence. They were completely at the mercy of, you know, whatever factory owner or mine owner or whatever they happened to be employed by. And we're seeing conditions like that develop again. You know, we're seeing, people today who work for Amazon and places like that, they're rapidly facing the same kind of problems that people working in a 19th century factory might have faced in terms of being totally at the mercy of employers. In more and more towns out in the Midwest, for example, you know, it's getting to where you only have one real employer, and it's somebody like Amazon, or, you know, it's an Amazon warehouse or something like that. So increasingly, employees are once again at the mercy of employers, particularly without unions or any of these kinds of things. And technology has been a core component of this. You know, it's been the digital revolution, the dramatic expansion of technology in recent decades that has brought about the kind of economy we see nowadays, and the kind of labor relations we see nowadays, and the kind of rising gap between rich and poor, and all of these kinds of things. You know, these kinds of 19th century economic conditions that are once again returning. Technological factors have been a core element of that, the technological changes that have taken place. So, you know, a big question would be, how do you have a balance of power in society while at the same time having Amazon, you know, having Amazon that can, you know, do a quick delivery of whatever you want to your door, or can you even have that? Is that possible? You know, is it possible to have social media and have a distribution of power in the wider society? I mean, nowadays you have these guys like, you know, Zuckerberg and all that who are pretty much just leading nations of their own is what it amounts to. Like, I saw a comment on some discussion forum today where somebody said, well, Bezos might as well be the president of the United States, because, you know, he has arguably as much, if not more, power, and certainly gets by with as much, you know. So where does that leave us?
Yeah, I think what might help is to give a concrete example. So if we look at classic socialist doctrine, the idea that was envisioned was Georges Sorel's the national strike, where it was a theoretical idea, but you would have near full employment or full employment, such that if you then sufficiently organize the workforce, you could all have a strike to then expropriate the means of production. Because if you have near full or full employment, they can't bring in scabs because there's nowhere to bring them in from. Now, one of the things that led to was that all historic socialist groups up until like the 1980s were in favor of immigration restriction, because immigration restriction would limit the labor supply so they could get closer to full employment. Now, the way it's been weaponized, I mean, even recently, as of 2016, Bernie Sanders said open borders was a Koch brothers conspiracy. And one of the problems that they saw, which the modern left has seemed to have given up on, I think in part because they buy into the argument, the underlying capitalist assumption of fungibility, is that it's supply and demand. If the labor supply is small, then the power of the laborer is relatively high, which is moving you closer to your goal of the national strike. Whereas if you dilute the labor force by making it cheaper, by having as many people as possible in it, then you end up actually doing the capitalist job for him, so that you're doing it for him, so he doesn't have to do it. And then you wonder why he's becoming more and more powerful, squeezing out the worker. Because there's a certain mathematical ratio that comes up. This is a friend of mine, Logos. You might know him, Keith. I don't think you would know of him, Derek. But he points out it's just basic mathematics. If the labor supply is like 50 people, each worker has a pretty high level of share control of the workforce. But if you then balloon it to 50,000, it's minuscule. The individual worker's power is just minuscule. And it makes it that much easier for the commodification of labor to take place. And another example that is concrete that might help is, well, certainly all of us would have criticisms of the current police force today. But at least the current police force is somewhat, in the United States, open to some form of democratic influence, and it's also distributed. Whereas by targeting it as racist and then using that as a way to dismantle it, using the left to do their job for them, that opens up the path for private security, like the Pinkertons, like Baldwin Felt's agency. And so what ends up happening is they then have gotten the left to do their job for them. In fact, Noam Chomsky in the 70s would have said, that's total tyranny. Having private security forces on the street is total tyranny. But now people like Chomsky are essentially advocating for policies that will inevitably lead to that. And I think part of why we see this contradiction develop, is because the left has adopted a lot of underlying assumptions that are parallel to capitalism that they've since, the capitalist managers have since realized and then sort of hacked or retroactively fitted to then have them do their work for them. And so now the left that used to be openly opposed to them is now unbeknownst, paving the way for the total rollerball society they might have been afraid of. So I'll give that to you, Derek.
Well, thanks for saying that, and thanks for passing it off too, because this is something that has... I've done some interviews about this. I interviewed Diana Johnstone about this. She's an old school lefty slash semi-commie, born in the 30s. And one of the interviews I did specifically with her was about how is it that the left has, that open borders has become a such a dogma on the left that, that if anyone expresses that there can be any limitations whatsoever on cross-border movement, that one loses one's honorary lefty card. And I don't really get it. And a joke I used to tell 15 years ago, and I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, a joke I used to tell 15 years ago was that I am in favor of closing borders on one condition, which is that you close it not only to the movement of humans, but also to the movement of resources. Because if you don't want the humans to cross, but you want the resources to cross, then what that means is I want the coffee that used to be on the land that used to belong to you, but I don't want you. But the thing that's going to get me in trouble is that I was actually kind of serious. It was a joke, but it was making a point that I completely agree. Old school lefties and people who are really interested in the working class were not in favor of open borders. And I don't really understand how that how that transition took place. It's the same. And I did another interview with Diana Johnstone too, specifically about how did the EU become an item of a dogma for the left, that the left used to be all about localization and all about maintaining as much local control as possible for exactly the reasons, Todd, that you said brilliantly about, you know, if you reduce the labor supply, the workers have more. And you said if there's 50 people versus 50,000, but especially if there are 1,000 jobs, if there's 50 workers and 1,000 jobs, the workers have, I mean, look at the Major League Baseball, you know, Players Association, probably the strongest union in the world, or it was a few years ago. And on the other hand, if you have 50,000 workers and 1,000 jobs, you're completely screwed. And in fact, there was a pro-slavery philosopher in the 1830s in the South who argued that if they could arrange working conditions like they had in the North in cities where you have a huge surplus of workers, that's actually way cheaper than slavery and a much more beneficial situation. So I guess this is just a long-winded way of saying I don't really understand how those, how that transition, and I completely agree with you on the police. I want to say something about that too. I used to teach at a supermax prison, Pelican Bay. And honestly, and this is going to piss off more lefties, my students at the prison thought that prison abolitionists were naive because they knew whom they were living with on a daily basis. And, you know, I had students who honestly, if you would have kept them off drugs, they'd be sweethearts, just perfectly nice neighbors. But, you know, they got involved with running heroin. I had one who got involved with running heroin. And then, he said the cops surrounded his house and he made the stupidest mistake of his life as he picked up a gun and shot at them. And he didn't hit anybody, but he would have gotten like 4 years. But because he shot at a cop, he got like 20. He said, stupidest thing I ever did in my life. He was actually an okay guy. I wouldn't mind having him a neighbor, keep him off drugs. And then I had other students who had gone out of their way to, like, some guy got carjacked by someone and they called this guy who came and tortured the guy to death for the fun of it, you know? And my students at the prison would say, if you abolish prisons, you're going to have to kill a lot of people because there are a lot of really nasty people in here. And also I'll just point out that poor neighborhoods of color often ask for increased police presence. They're not asking. I mean, because as I interviewed years ago, Christian Parenti, who wrote a book sort of against cops, but he had more of a nuanced approach than we see these days. And he argued that, he said that a lot of poor people that he interviewed, poor inner city people and poor inner city black people, they said, look, the problem is not, the cops aren't even the most well-organized and well-armed gang that we have to face. You know, our lives are destroyed by other gangs too. And in many cases, they argued for increased police protection. And it's, I'm not saying police shouldn't be reformed. It's just, every society, this just kills me. How the left has become so freaking nuts is every society has had means to, and this is something that kills me about a lot of anarchism too, is there are really smart anarchists who argue that, no, we are not arguing against laws. We are arguing for a society in which people have transformed enough that we no longer need those laws. And sure, we can, and then we can talk about the problems associated with technology with that. But then there are other anarchists who argue against laws whatsoever. I had one anarchist get really mad, John Zerzan, got really mad at me and was slamming me in public because I said, I don't have a problem with laws against rape. And that's just insane. And that, so I don't understand. Okay, I'm gonna say one more thing and then perhaps you can all help me. I don't understand how the left has lost its mind so completely on these and lost its mind and how the left, insofar as the Democrats are left, which is not really the case, but how you can have so-called lefties call working class people deplorables. It just, this kills me how the left has moved away from that. So answer me this. That's one of the things I wanted to learn from both of you is how has the left lost its collective mind?
I'll throw this to you, Keith, but I want to answer Derek first. So to put it as concisely as possible, what I think is going on here is that in rejecting in toto the traditional mores that came before the Enlightenment, the left has left out a lot of good ideas that could help develop a communal, fraternal, solidarity society. And what we're seeing now is the logical outworking of the Enlightenment industrial values that they adopted, and we're just competing with the capitalists on who could do it better. And since they had the same goals in mind, and it seems that the earlier experiments failed, they've sort of come full circle and are now consistently acting in the way that the right, the quote unquote Enlightenment right is. because they're coming from the same starting point. They diverged, but the left has converged back to the Enlightenment right because they're coming from the same starting point. They just thought that they had a better way to get to the end state, and apparently enough of them were convinced that they didn't, especially with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And they're like, well, okay, if we can have all of this stuff with capitalism, well, we wanted it all along. So yeah, that's great. And I think that is the shorthand for all of this. But I'll let you answer that, Keith.
It's a complicated issue, but it's one that I've looked at quite a bit. And I think this is the general narrative of why the left has gone in the direction it has. There was actually an interesting paper that was published a few months ago by Thomas Piketty and some associates. And, you know, Piketty is an economist. He's well respected on the left, the anti-globalization left and all of that. But he examined the electoral politics of 21 Western democracies. And what he found is that in virtually all of these, I think there were two countries, I forget which ones, but there were a couple that were partial exceptions. But he said, as a general rule, what he found was this. When you look at the conflict between the left-wing parties and the right-wing parties, previously, say in the early to middle 20th century, the left was the party of the working class, you know, the poor and working class. The right was the party of the upper middle and upper class, roughly. Rich and poor is what it amounted to. But he said that that's not the case today. Like the left versus the right today is an intra-elite conflict. And the analogy he uses is to Indian society. He said in traditional India, in the caste system, you have the four basic castes. You've got the Brahmins, who are like the scholarly, educated class. You've got the merchant class. You've got the military class. You've got the workers, the Shudras. And then, of course, you've got the non-caste people, the Dalits and indigenous and all of that. And he was saying that what class politics in the Western world today is like is it's like the right now represents the merchant class, the business class, and as well as the military and all of that. And then the left represents not the working class or the poor. It represents the Brahmins. It represents the educated, professorial, managerial. It represents, that like there are some social theorists now who talk about a professional managerial class, and they say that this is really the basis of the left today. It's urbanized, educated, professional people, people who are affluent and upwardly mobile, who generally have fairly cosmopolitan values. You know, they like immigration because they like their ethnic restaurants and all that kind of stuff. And this, I think, is really the base of what passes for the left in the Western world today. What passes for the left is this professional managerial class, and also parallel to that, the technological elite. That goes back to what I was saying earlier about James Burnham's thesis way back in the 1940s about the rise of the managerial elite. He was saying, well, the old classical bourgeoisie of, big shot capitalists is being superseded by this class of managers who just run these mass organizations. But now what's happened is that you have not only the managerial class, but then the digital revolution has produced a new type of oligarchy, a new type of capitalist oligarchy rooted in these new technologies. So today what you have on the so-called left is you have the tech oligarchs. You've got the Bill Gates and the Bezos and all these kinds of people, the Zuckerbergs, aligned with this urban, affluent, upper middle class of professional people and managerial people. And these are the people that are concentrated in what I call the ideas industries, like education, journalism, media, entertainment, the arts, human resources, marketing, advertising. These are the folks who become diversity officers, and some of them are in the traditional professions, law and all that kind of stuff. But these people are culturally liberal. I mean, they're not they're not faith, flag, and family conservatives. They find people like Pat Buchanan very distasteful. They're all for diversity. They like their ethnic restaurants. They have no problem with their gay friends and all of that kind of stuff. But they're not workers in the traditional sense. They're not working class, certainly. They're not poor. They are basically the modern Brahmin class. They're the educated professional class elites. In fact, another bit of research that was done recently showed that the principal dividing line in the culture wars in the United States, that is, whether somebody's going to be a part of the red tribe and tend to vote Republican, or whether somebody's going to be part of the blue tribe and tend to vote Democrat, the real basis of the culture wars is not social class, it's not race, it's actually education level. The more someone has been through the university system, the more likely they are to be a devout Democratic Party voter. I think what that basically means is that the culture wars are essentially like a quasi-religious or existential war between those who say share the values of this Brahmin class on one hand and those who have some other value system, whether it's the traditional American civil religion, you know, that Robert Vella wrote about, or whether it's traditional religion in a more conventional sense, you know, evangelical Christianity or Catholicism or something like that. But I think that's the real basis of the left and right in the Western world today. The left is not the working class or the poor. It's the educated Brahmin class and the tech oligarchs. That's who's really calling the shots on the so-called left. They benefit from immigration economically because a lot of them have livelihoods that are rooted in it. You know, if you own a business, you want cheap immigrant labor. You know, if you run a social service agency, you want clients for your services. That's going to guarantee you a job. You know, you want voters for your political party. You want clients for whatever kind of, you know, social services you're administering. I think that's a big part of it there. Another thing, though, that I do think enters into this is that the one reason that I think the left has become so fixated on open borders is they associate all opposition to immigration with racism. And I think that, you know, because you had such awful things that happened in the 20th century, like the Holocaust, and because of the legacy you see of certain things in this country, like slavery and Jim Crow and segregation, I think that a lot of sectors of the left have become somewhat pathological about these kinds of things, in the sense that, well, no, we can't have even the slightest restriction on immigration because that'll lead to the Holocaust. You know, it's this kind of lowest common denominator, you know, kind of almost a neurotic view that's a sort of a reaction against the past. Also, I think we have to consider, too, this kind of wider enlightenment concept of something like the citizen of the world. You know, a core strand of enlightenment thinking was we're going to break down all of these traditional barriers, you know, the caste and class and rank and, you know, more particular forms of identity, and I'm going to be a citizen of the world. You know, like Thomas Paine, that was one of the things he was famous for saying, I'm a citizen of the world. So if you really have this kind of outlook, well, okay, why do we need to restrict immigration? You know, because we're all citizens of the world. You know, so the world is just one big country. You know, I mean, without it really considering some of the ramifications or some of the negatives in that. And the defund the police thing, as soon as I heard that slogan, I'm like, yeah, that's really going to happen. You know, like these, you know, urban cosmopolitan professional people, you know, these, you know, attorneys who have politically correct social views, you know, like, you know, I mean, if these are like, I live not too far from D.C. I know people who live in the D.C. suburbs who say, yeah, you know, my neighborhood, everybody, these are all affluent people who they've all got their BLM flag out. They've all got their, you know, Orange Man bad, you know, flag, and they've all got their rainbow pride flag and all that kind of stuff, you know. So these are people who pride themselves on their cosmopolitan values. At the same time, they don't want their neighborhood to not be policed. They don't want the police to just go away. You know, I mean, particularly the more affluent ones that live in the gated communities and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So I think that's where really the gist of the issue, though, that Derek was discussing is that the left today is not a working class left or a poor people's left. It's sort of like the left wing of the middle class or the left wing of the capitalist class.
Yeah, well, this has been a very interesting discussion, but it's about time to start wrapping up. So what I'll say is my final thoughts is what I think we're seeing here is that when the left originated, there were some things that it saw in traditional societies that it liked, you know, localism, community, and things like that. But it also liked what, you know, the Enlightenment was saying about the new man, you know, overcoming the defects of the older society. And so I think what ended up happening is, on one hand, they threw the baby out with the bathwater, because when you throw out all of the earlier ideas, whether it's, you know, ancient Hellenism or medieval Christianity or Reformation Christianity, you sort of lose some of the underpinnings that allow for local communities to develop. But then on the other hand, they thought that the commodification of life that the Enlightenment brought was terrible. And they're like, we don't want that. So we're going to have Enlightenment values, but avoid that. And I think what's ended up happening is that's a kind of contradiction. And that contradiction eventually has worked itself out where they've either had to decide, well, are we going to keep the Enlightenment values and accept the commodification of life or not? And that's led to a split. I mean, I don't want to say that everybody's followed that direction, but I think that's largely the untangling of a philosophical consistency issue. That's what I would say is, and then you can work it down to unique contextual historical events. So Derek, what would your final thoughts be?
I guess my final thoughts would just be, I want to thank both of you for the conversation and for, as always, helping me understand or try to work my way through some very thorny issues. And you know, you said, what was it you said? The protection of community and one other thing. What was it?
Localism. Localism? Was that it? Solidarity?
Well, in any case, I just come back to, it's not really possible to support community when you have these distant economic entities controlling things. And yeah, I love the fact that both of you are really highlighting the contradictions inherent in these positions. And I guess the last thing I want to do is ask a question, which is how do we, however we can, work to bring the interests of the working class back into leftist politics?
All right. Keith, I'll give you the last word for today.
Well, I have noticed, as I said earlier, there's this renewed interest in socialism among a lot of people on the left, you know, younger people in particular. Now, a lot of it is just an internet subculture, and a lot of it seems to be LARPing. But I think because of the situation that we see in the wider society, where we see, you know, the wealth gap between rich and poor is the widest it's been in a century, and we see the decimation of the traditional working to middle class that emerged in the post-war period, there is this renewed interest in, you know, working class issues, I think, among a lot of people on the left. And it's actually controversial. You know, you actually have people on the left who are advocating for a more working class oriented approach, and they get labeled class reductionists, you know, or they're saying, well, you just want to appeal to racists on the right, you know, you just so you can get more votes or whatever. So there's, you know, the intersectional left and then the more, more specifically race-oriented left and some of these other sectors of the left have actually really attacked the more class-oriented left over some of these kinds of issues. But I do think, though, that there will be populism seems to be growing both on the left and on the right. And I think it's largely in response to the things that are actually happening in the wider society. Now, how far that's going to go and what form it's going to take, I don't know. But I do see that happening. So that's how I would answer Derek's question.
All right. Again, thank you, Keith. Thank you, Derek. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. This is Todd Lewis of the Present Fellow Podcast. Sign off.